And welcome back to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? I am Ray Powell coming you get back to you from Manila again. Jim, I understand you are back from your escapades up in Vermont.
I am back in the midst of a truly epic thunderstorm with 80 mile an hour winds. So it seems appropriate for our guest tonight.
Well, if our guest is going to be a thunderstorm, maybe that'll increase our ratings.
We do whatever we can. Well, our guest tonight is Mike Pezzullo, a longtime civil servant advisor to Labor Party. Last from 2017, I think, was permanent secretary of the Department of Home Affairs, which in American parlance is sort of like Homeland Security. Mike, welcome. Really pleased to have you with us.
Jim, great to be here with you and great to reconnect with you. And Ray, also great to be with you as well.
Okay. And I think, Jim, you failed to mention he's actually down under. He's in Australia.
Oh, that's right. I assume everyone knows just when he opens his mouth, they know where he's from. But you're right.
So I'm coming to you from Canberra.
Oh, okay. Great. Well, Mike, let's get right to it. We've had a lot of guests talking about the challenge of China, and this is something obviously you focus on during your career. But in the recent article, you wrote about the issue of defense procurement and weapons production. And I guess why, we always ask, why should we care? Why should we care that this is such a big issue for a country like Australia, which seems to procure a lot of things from the U.S.? And we've discussed in the U.S. there are issues with weapons procurement as well.
Well, Jim, to answer that question, I just need to take a slight step back and to take it back to the geopolitical and geostrategic level. It strikes me, as I've thought about these issues since leaving government service, which I did in September of last year, I've had a chance to really deeply immerse myself in literature and the think tank reports, academic articles, in commentary, podcasts and the like, and taking a step back and getting out of the day-to-day misery of management and administration and really taking a chance to look at things strategically. Obviously, by that stage, a year and a half into when I left government service, Putin's illegal invasion of the Ukraine following the illegal annexation of Crimea some 10 years before. I should take the opportunity to mention, particularly for non-Australian but other colleagues in the Asia-Pacific, today, of course, is the 10th anniversary of the downing of MH17. Nearly 300 souls were lost in that illegal, barbaric act, 38 of whom were Australians, when a Russian missile battery crossed into the occupied part of eastern Ukraine, where Russia was supporting insurgents, and they shot down a Malaysian flight, downing it and killing all on board. So I just make mention of that because I want to come back to Putin in a moment, and it'll sort of cohere at that point. So whether it's across what's happening in the eastern flank of Eurasia. And of course, we had the NATO summit recently in Washington, where some commentary was made about the interconnectedness between what's happening in the Euro-Atlantic region and the Indo-Pacific region. And of course, since I left government service, you've had Hamas's barbaric attack into Israel in October, setting off tensions in the Middle East, including the prospect, not yet realised, but the prospect of further conflict in the Middle East, including a war with Hezbollah in the north and potentially proxy or other conflict with Iran. So the Eurasian geopolitical space is heating up, and it's heating up in not good ways. In fact, the most peaceful part of the Eurasian strategic system at the moment is actually the Indo-Pacific. Yes, there are non-lethal grey zone clashes in the Western Philippines. And of course, you've seen a ratcheting up of violence there where a Filipino military officer lost a hand or a thumb as more aggressive tactics are being used. We're also seeing the pressure being put onto Taiwan with more crossings into the median line, both of ships and aircraft. But for all of that, the Indo-Pacific is actually the quietest of the three Eurasian theatres. I say Eurasian theatres because I do see an interconnectivity here, Jim, which will answer the question about defence procurement. There is absolutely no question that an axis has now emerged, a very clear axis has emerged between Moscow, Beijing, Pyongyang, Tehran, and possibly others who either are masking their intentions at the moment or being rather more ginger in their approach to forming an axis with those four powers. So you've got the axis quad, the evil quad, if I can use that term. So the global pressure on armaments, regrettably, when we should actually be, as President Eisenhower said towards the end of his presidency, spending on armaments is an opportunity cost that you don't then spend on roads, hospitals, on aged care, and all the other things that a decent civilized society provides for its own economy, for its own elderly, for its own children. Every dollar you spend on armaments is a dollar diverted from those other social and economic purposes. However, we just have to face reality here that the global demand for military armaments, be they the resupply of ammunition, be they drones and autonomous vehicles, be they large weapon systems, artillery pieces, armoured vehicles, and in the Western Pacific and in the Indo-Pacific, more maritime capability and kit, obviously, the global aggregate demand is going to increase. And so, therefore, taking European, North American, US principally, of course, and other defence industries as a zero sum just simply means we will cannibalise each other's supply chains as we get in the queue for armaments, be they artillery shells or ammunition or autonomous vehicles and the like. So therefore, the aggregate level of defence production has to increase, regrettably, to deal with these challenges across the Eurasian theatre. And as we did in the Eurasian geostrategic system, and as we did in the Second World War, where Australia produced, in fact, most of the armaments, or at least the ammunition that Douglas MacArthur used, for instance. So we have to do our part in being a part of the arsenal of democracy. And so, therefore, Australia has to add to that aggregate level of production.
Mike, the term arsenal of democracy, coming sort of back from Franklin Roosevelt, was a wartime term. And we as democracies don't have a great history of increasing the production of weapons outside of an imminent threat or an actual war. So how do you develop a sense of urgency in a democracy sufficient to make the kinds of changes you're talking about when your average Australian or American or Filipino or Japanese citizen maybe doesn't wake up in the morning and think about an imminent threat?
Ray, that's a very good point. And I think it's just an intrinsic paradox of living in a free society. Democracies start slow and they finish strong. Martial societies, authoritarian societies, dictatorships start stronger, but they're actually more brittle. Their economies don't have the vibrancy, don't have the creative energies within themselves to generate the kinds of supplies that we're talking about. The Soviet Union, for instance, was critically reliant upon US armaments being shipped through convoys, very dangerous convoys through the North Atlantic, for its war effort. Now, of course, the Soviet Union, as allies against Hitler and Mussolini, provided a lot of the frontline fighting until, of course, the invasion of France through D-Day in 1944. But the Russians, the Soviets, as they then were, would not have stood a chance had those factories in America, under the leadership of the War Production Board, established by President Roosevelt, with Bill Knutson being asked to take up that role, being the managing director of General Motors, and famously saying to the president, "I'll do the job for $1 a year," according to his autobiography. And he spent 4 years as that effort expanded. The United States went into that war in the late 1930s with one of the smallest militaries that it ever had in its history. By 1945, the American population, supported through both the recruitment effort and the training effort, but also the material effort, the largest military that the world had ever seen in 4 short years. However, you cannot summon, and indeed, in a sense, we don't want our democracies to be in a permanent state of being militarized. And so there's this paradox of hitting that sweet spot where you don't start too late so that the tyrants and the authoritarian dictators don't get a head start on you as they particularly grab territory or engage in offensive actions. You don't start too late, but equally you don't start too soon when the citizenry is not ready. I think, Ray, we're getting close to that tipping point, and that's where political leadership, whether it's in Washington, in London, in the European capitals, in Canberra, in Ottawa, in Wellington and elsewhere, that's where the political leadership needs to come together, both individually within societies, but also multilaterally within alliance structures and partnerships and the like. And of course, I add Tokyo and Seoul to that equation as well, as well as Manila. And so, look, as much as it pains us to say this, there are gathering storms. We do need to start lift the rate of both military production, but also increasing the size of our armed forces. But also these days, because warfare has changed, we also need to start to lift our cyber defences, protect our critical infrastructure, make sure that our supply chains can actually sustain weeks, months, potentially years of armed conflict. And of course, the equation there will be dependent on whether there's escalation using nuclear weapons. But it might be quite conceivable to see quite a long, drawn-out conventional war where both sides or all the sides of the conflict are self-restraining with regards to the use of nuclear weapons, which, of course, was not in prospect until the very end of the Second World War. So it is the paradox of living freely that we tend to start late, but we finish strong.
So in a recent article, Mike, you wrote about the idea to kickstart weapons production through the use of a defense industry board of some sort. Could you sort of describe why and what that would look like?
Well, in the Australian context, given our legislative and regulatory framework, the proposal that I advanced a few weeks ago now would be for the creation of a statutory commission headed up by a dedicated defence production commissioner whose sole job would be to, for Australian Indigenous purposes, but adding to the aggregate level of, if you like, the arsenal of today's democracies, a statutorily empowered commissioner who would be joined by two key officers, the Secretaries of Defence and the Secretary of Industry. Now, particularly for American audience, in this context, the Secretary is a senior civil servant who reports to the Cabinet Minister. So in our countries, the Minister is the elected official in Cabinet and the civil servant is known as the Secretary. So they're the equivalent of the Deputy Secretaries in American departments. That would be a very powerful trio who would then be afforded by our Parliament special procurement powers, which actually allowed them to speed up procurement activity, going from proposals to contract in matters of days and weeks, depending on the nature of the technology, months in some cases if the technology had to be proven up, and having an autonomy from our normal regulatory and procurement restrictions that would allow them to cut through that red tape. And that commission obviously would still be accountable to the Parliament. They would have to still keep the receipts for their actions and be able to account for their actions, but they'd have decisive cut-through powers to effectively do what was done at the start of the Second World War, which were letters of intent and almost in some cases handshake deals with the lawyers following up the next day. Now, as a matter of best practice, we should avoid handshake deals, but in an emergency, if that's what's required, with a lawyer then codifying it in a letter of intent, so be it.
So back to political will, because I think that's really the question here is, and you bring up the number in your article. You talk about the number 20% chance of war in the Western Pacific, essentially by the end of the decade. That is, by some measures, 20% is a low number. But when you're talking about something as catastrophic as war, of course, that's a terrifying number. And of course, once again, this is not a reality that most people live. What, in your view, would, if there were to be war, like a major theater war involving, say China or China, by the end of the decade, and we did not take these steps as Western democracies, we did not ramp up defense production, what is the scenario that could emerge that would demonstrate our unpreparedness, and how bad could that be?
Well, in the extreme case, defeat. I mean, you have a situation where if you haven't dispersed your force, if you haven't equipped it, if you haven't got wartime stocks ready, depending on the nature of the conflict, and just dealing purely with open source simulations that have been prepared by CSIS or RAND or CSBA or CNAS and other organisations that have looked at this without at all touching on anything that might be in the classified realm, there are a number of options open to China's leadership, whether it's in the Taiwan scenario, blockade, quarantine, which could potentially emerge almost unsighted just based on increasing the tempo of maritime movements around Taiwan, and then all of a sudden one day a blockade is decreed. It could, in more extreme scenarios, involve a series of Pearl Harbor-type strikes, probably using longer-range missiles rather than aircraft carriers, hypersonic missiles and ballistic and cruise missiles, to destroy American response capability. Some scholars think that that wouldn't be the case, that they think that a quick envelopment of Taiwan before US forces could react, and not attacking, for instance, Kadena or Guam or Darwin would be the preferred course. I think there are any number of scenarios that deeply expert military analysts could apply their mind to when they do a military appreciation, but all roads lead to one place, and that is, if we're caught short without a mobilized force, without that force dispersed, without that force being in its wartime locations or close to its wartime locations, if wartime stocks mean that we run out of ammunition on the second day, if our cyber defenses can be breached easily, and we shouldn't regrettably ignore the possibility of physical sabotage as well as the potential for a proxy action by saboteurs, and indeed potentially assassination activities potentially carried out by either special forces, clandestine operatives, or proxies operating on behalf of the attacking force. And those assassinations and those physical sabotage activities could occur in, for instance, Taiwan to decapitate the leadership, or indeed it could occur in allied and partner countries just to create that initial sense of shock. If we're not ready, the scenario that is potentially before us, Ray, is defeat on the first morning.
So there are those voices in Australia who either are accommodationists, who say basically, let's just do the best we can with China, not be so closely associated with the U.S. and find a way to get along. And those who posit the echidna strategy, basically the poison shrimp of Singapore. Australia just would be too difficult to swallow, so let's build up our own forces independently. So what's your response to those views?
Well, I think in the scenario that I just sketched out in response to Ray's question, it goes without saying that prior to that phase coming to pass, diplomacy would still be working overtime. In the same way that Japanese and American diplomats were engaging right up until the morning of Pearl Harbor, and hopefully this time with a different result if it comes to that. Our diplomatic services, our foreign ministers, the Secretary of State would all be actively engaged. No one is suggesting for a moment, Jim, I'm certainly not suggesting, that we give up on diplomacy now and say, right, let's start to harden the force. It's a parallel dual action where the hardening of the force, ramping up production, the mobilization of the force, its dispersal, putting the force either in its full wartime locations or being ready to spring into wartime locations, is done as a second track to the prime track, which is to build confidence, to de-escalate, to try to get to an accommodation with an increasingly aggressive Chinese leadership, where President Xi has made it very clear, if not in this term of his current leadership, his third term, certainly through the course of his fourth term, because he gets to his own biological destiny at some point, and he'll run out of his own biological runway to achieve the things that he clearly wants to achieve. When he talks about national rejuvenation, the crown jewel of that is the annexation or the incorporation, or use whatever political term you wish, of Taiwan, and pushing Beijing sovereignty onto Taiwan, which of course in military terms means that it becomes the crown jewel of their military posture in the Western Pacific. So to have an Australian response to that, and yes, you're right, there is a debate here in Australia that vigorously contests even just the premise of the scenario I've sketched out. Some people say it won't get to that because that's either not their design, or if it is their design, it's kind of natural, and so therefore it should be allowed to happen. Their ascendancy, their primacy should be allowed to assert itself, because some argue that only the US has got the capacity to thwart that, and the US is either lacking in will, lacking in capacity, lacking in capability, or lacking in the interest to thwart that outcome. And so why then as a third party in a bilateral resolution at the grand strategic level between Beijing and Washington, why insert ourselves into something which might well be plausible? Some of my colleagues who argue for, I wouldn't call it necessarily an accommodationist strategy, but it's certainly a strategy that accepts the inevitability of China's primacy in Asia-Pacific and indeed the Indo-Pacific. Some of my colleagues argue that for the Americans, it's not worth the fight. So therefore, that result should be accepted without the catastrophe of the possibility of a war. The so-called echidna strategy, some of your viewers would have heard of, is promoted by some of my colleagues who say, look, it might well be the case that the US and China come to blows. In other words, it's a third position that says the US might decide that it's got an interest in prosecuting or pushing back on Chinese strategic power and Chinese ascendancy, but we have no interest in pushing forward. In other words, we're a long way, use the space that we have, the distance that we have, to stay out of the fight and to defend ourselves locally with significantly increased conventional forces, typically people who pursue the echidna strategy, which is a marsupial with very sharp spikes, very difficult for predators to, if they kill it, it's very hard to eat, or the poison shrimp strategy, as you mentioned, that Singapore has. The problem with that approach, Jim, just to deal with that one first, is we are, by treaty obligation and in my argument, by strategic interest, deeply committed to ensuring that that future of Chinese, of a presumed, and I don't presume it, Chinese strategic ascendancy in the Western Pacific, we've actually got an interest as well as a treaty obligation in ensuring that that doesn't happen. If US forces are attacked in the Pacific area, in my simple reading of our treaty, we're in the fight. And that's before you get to the deeply, deeply intertwined and interconnected intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, and military capabilities that we have. So in my mind, Jim, we have to opt out of that fight if we get to that point and we choose to stay out of it, because we've already opted in. And as to a local defence strategy, I think the Chinese calculation would be, if it came to it, and this does presume that it, to pick up points made by some of my colleagues, that the US has an interest in pushing forward and indeed pushing forward to the point of potential military conflict. In my judgment, the Chinese, looking geopolitically and geostrategically at the battle space, would have to calculate on strikes into Australia, because they simply could not afford to have so much strategic space made available to the United States, as was made available in 1942, and leave it immune. It just, in my mind, and this is just purely based on open source reading of Chinese literature, particularly their military journals, they would have to, if not certainly make Australia a primary target, they would have to strike at certain points in Australia simply to deny that strategic space to American forces.
So in terms of that Chinese view of what it looks out at and sees, and whether or not what it is seeing might be able to deter that kind of aggression. We in the United States have seen a discussion about evolving our hub and spoke model of alliances into what is often referred to as a lattice work. And in the Western Pacific, we've seen that turn into this series of reciprocal access agreements. Australia has them now with Japan and the Philippines, and actually the Philippines just concluded one with Japan, which sort of seems to complete this at least grouping of these four countries into something like a lattice work. And in fact, I believe that one of the terms that's emerged recently has been to differentiate it from the Quad, which is more of a political grouping at this point. They've called it the Squad. At least they do up here in the Philippines. What is the impact of these reciprocal access agreements? What's practically, what does it mean? And then symbolically and in terms of deterrence, does this actually have the potential to deter China from its aggressions?
Ray, I think it does, but it's at the lighter end of deterrence. I'm a strong supporter of the lattice strategy. Deputy Secretary Campbell's used that term, Secretary Blinken has, and others as well. I'm a supporter of it. But I'm more favorably disposed to thickening, if you like, the struts of the lattice. You can have in your garden a very thin timber lattice, which is reasonably easy to break, or you can have a lattice in a construction site that's steel and reinforced concrete. I prefer for the harder version of a lattice rather than the sort of lattice that you'd have where you might grow some vines over a fence. But look, it's a good start. What it means practically is that the hub and spoke model, famously termed after the series of treaties that were signed in San Francisco in 1951, very different from the NATO construct, as I think everyone who's got a passing interest in these matters would know. In 1949, NATO is established as a truly multilateral military alliance with Article 5 assurances. Very different situation in the Pacific area, and for reasons to do with signing a peace treaty with Japan and re-energizing Japanese industrial development, the United States at the time decided on a course of bilateral security agreements that everyone famously that everyone describes as the hub and spoke model. The lattice is really about creating struts between the spokes. This might be newsworthy and might push your ratings along. I think that the lattice work, though, is, or the lattice strategy, whether it's a timber flimsy lattice or a steel and reinforced concrete lattice that you find in a construction site, I think itself is only a midpoint strategy. I think at some point, as we get closer to 26, 27, if we get through 27 and the National Congress in likely to be in October of 27, where I think there'd be very high odds of President Xi seeking and gaining a fourth term. I think by that stage, some kind of Pacific area treaty construct will have to be seriously considered. And it was, as we know, toyed about or toyed with CETO in the early 1950s. That didn't really go anywhere. And CETO went to well into the Indian Ocean area. It had Pakistan in it, for instance. But a Pacific area treaty organization, I think, is something that we should seriously consider, a collective security agreement, because by that stage, and I'm not talking about any time soon, and I understand the different sensitivities. Being an Australian security official for so long, I'm deeply aware of and alert to the sensitivities with ASEAN, with individual ASEAN countries. There are particular issues that apply in Korea because of the armistice arrangements and the particular military planning and governance arrangements in Korea. I'm deeply aware of the history and why it's principally, in the case of Japan, a US-Japan bilateral arrangement, although that's changing for the reasons you've just spoken about. But, Ray, if we have the good fortune of getting through the next couple of years without these incidents either in the Senkakus or in and around the Western Philippines or around Taiwan, I think rather than waking up every morning saying, well, the danger's past, I think we wake up every morning saying the sand is leaving the hourglass, because Xi has now invested so much in this concept of national rejuvenation with the acquisition, annexation, subjugation of Taiwan as being the centrepiece, that every day that doesn't happen is a day that we get closer to that reckoning. Because I doubt very much, and it'd be fascinating to see what psychological profiles people have been able to garner of the president, the general secretary, as he more properly is. His presidential office is really just an accoutrement on his role as the head of the party. I can't see the man waking up one day saying, you know what, maybe I've pushed this a bit too hard. Maybe in the interest of global prosperity, maybe in the interest of a better world and dealing with other issues such as poverty, climate, and so on and so forth, maybe I should change my approach. I just don't see the guy changing. And so therefore, if imagine this scenario, it's late 2026, we're going into 27, nothing major or significant has happened. There might have been some skirmishes, there might have been incidents at sea, there might have been potentially very challenging incidents that have de-escalated, but we've managed to avoid the big one. as we go into 2027 and going back to Ian Easton's book of some years ago, when you look at the most opportune military conditions in terms of tide and typhoon conditions, and we're getting through that March-April period, which is only some 33 months away, March-April of 2027, they're getting ready for their Congress. They're getting ready for the 100th anniversary of the founding of the PLA as the armed wing of the CCP. That is a very dangerous time. That's a very, very dangerous time. And I just wonder aloud, and I'm just sketching this in my own mind as I'm speaking to you, I just wonder whether an alliance system based on the strategic assumptions of 1951 would cut it in those circumstances in 2027.
Well, let's, if we play that out with U.S. domestic politics as part of it, let's go to what a potential second Trump administration would look like. We know historically President Trump was fairly transactional. You can envision perhaps him seeing he could make a deal with China over Taiwan, and we don't know what else. But you worked a lot with Trump, senior Trump officials during your time. Did you see any indication of that transactional approach in your dealings, or what would you expect from a second Trump administration?
Well, just reflecting more on the open literature, Jim, but obviously if you and I and Ray, we all recall our times in government service fondly, and it's impossible to put those perspectives out of mind. But grounding this answer on the evidence that I can see in the literature, and of course the president, should he become president again, Mr. Trump in this case would be the final decision maker, but it seems to be, and it'll be intriguing to see who he surrounds himself with in terms of cabinet appointees, sub-cabinet appointees, who the National Security Advisor is, who the US Trade Representative is, who the Treasury Secretary is. It seems to me that the calculus, at least in the early parts of the Trump administration, would be to be quite forceful with China. And that is to say, I think a Trump administration, a second Trump administration, would actually start with the premise, the very ancient premise that trade follows the flag. If the American flag is withdrawn from the Western Pacific and East Asia, then think about things like trade agreements. Think about things like the issue a few years ago with 5G. If China is ascendant commercially in investment terms, in trade terms, in the Western Pacific and in East Asia, if American companies are not competing, if American investment has fallen off, if trade with non-Chinese economies has fallen off, does anyone seriously think that when the Chinese delegation arrives to talk about your 6G network or your 7G network or co-investing in smart cities programs or maybe signing up to Belt and Road, if there's a perception that America has withdrawn to its side of the Pacific and that some grand economic bargain to create, a geopolitical division of influence, does anyone seriously think that Australia, for instance, would make the decision that we made in 2018 to block high risk, which effectively meant Chinese companies, from building our 5G network? In other words, a so-called deal, which I know is talked about, would actually give strategic primacy to China, not just militarily, but most critically commercially. And I just don't see a proud US administration that wants to see American goods, services and products dominate through their competitive excellence, through the quality of their design, through the quality of their the features of whatever it is, whether it's telecommunication services or biotech services or manufactured goods. I just don't see America withdrawing. And so it seems to me that the commercial side, the trade side of this is intertwined with the military side. I think under a Trump administration, my guess would be, just reading the literature that I've been reading, is that America would in fact double down on its Indo-Pac or its Indo-Pacific presence. And indeed, as I understand the debate within the Republican Party, and you see this sometimes play out in Congress, there'd probably be an inclination to say, well, you know what? Yes, Russia is a threat, but it's not existential. Europe can deal with Russia by and large. And yes, there'll be American underwriting of European security through NATO, but the grand strategic equation that, if you like, will shape the destiny of the world is the G2 relationship between the US and China. And I just don't think America is for softening in that contest.
Well, Mike, we like to get out on a little bit of a lighter note. So for our next question today, when you travel around the world, and especially to the United States, what is it that you look most forward to when you get actually into the United States? Is it food? Is there a particular restaurant you like? What is it that when you plan your trip to the U.S., what's at the top of your list?
Well, Ray, I'm a history tragic, and I haven't been able to do this enough in the latter part of my career. But in the early part of my career, when I was able to travel to the US through various roles that I had, I was able to take approved leave or separately when I travelled there with my family. So I've been to Gettysburg three times, having taken my family, my then young children, who were interested at first, but by the time we got to about the 20th Union Regiment, as we walked along Cemetery Ridge, they were saying, "Dad, is there a hot dog place, you know, close by?" So on this occasion, and my grandchildren are just a little bit too young for that, but it's visiting those incredible sites of America's history. Be they in Boston with the sites connected with the Revolutionary War, be it Gettysburg and some of the great Civil War sites. I'm a complete tragic. I haven't been to all the battlefields, so I've got to do one on every trip to the US now to close out my repertoire of Civil War battlefields.
Well, it's time for you to look at the Revolutionary battles, because I'm right near the Saratoga battlefield, which of course was the turning point of our revolution. Where yes. We beat the Bloody Palms and captured General Burgoyne.
So we're all friends now, Jim. Through AUKUS, we're all friends.
Okay, if you say so.
Well, on that light note, thank you, Michael Pezzulla, for having joined us. Thank you for your recent article and for provoking us to think through this question of defense production. And we do wish you a good day, sir, and hope you'll be back with us sometime.
Great. I very much would look forward to that. Thank you.
Okay, Jim. Well, that ended kind of on a very interesting note. I think Mike was breaking a little news in his advocacy of a Pacific Area Treaty Organization, what was it called, PAITO, or something to that effect. You know, so that's certainly a provocative idea.
Well, PATO in Spanish means duck, so I hope they come up with something else. Yeah. But it's pretty sobering. Basically, he seems to say that he has no doubt that China's going to make a move on Taiwan, if not the South China Sea, by 2027-28 timeframe. And to help forestall that and add additional deterrence, he's advocating for this Pacific alliance.
Yeah. He might not agree with no doubt, since he's written publicly that the chances is around 20% of war by the end of the decade.
Yeah, but he seems to think 20% is a pretty big number.
Yeah. Well, it is a big number if you're talking about major theater war. You know, I've thought a lot about treaties and whether they still are. I mean, so there are still countries joining NATO. So that treaty obviously has stood the test of time and has generated additional interest from countries that have not previously done treaties. But of course, no such history exists in the Pacific. And, just because it's such a new thing, it's hard to sort of conceptualize. I mean, of course, other than having the hub and spoke thing that emerged right after World War II. So, and there doesn't seem to be any great groundswell at this point. But, you know, I mean, I guess if the threat perception around war with China grows, I suppose there could be, you know, energy for that. But I don't, you know, it's hard to see it going beyond the current U.S. treaty allies.
Yeah, I it depends on how people are viewing the threat and what they see as a useful form of deterrence.
Yeah.
But I guess you start somewhere, and Mike has always been one not reluctant to start rolling the boulder up the hill.
Well, I mean, he's obviously a really intelligent guy, and it's and you know, somebody who we should certainly listen to. But speaking of intelligent guys, I'm going to get into my there I was story. And my father is an intelligent guy. In fact, he's a PhD in mathematics. And when I was growing up, there was a lot of discussion in the family about who got what was referred to then as the Powell brain. And it wasn't, you know, it was my dad's brain, right? Who got that? And there were two naturally born children, you know, who were genetically tied to my father. As I say, we have a couple of adopted kids in the family as well. But since, you know, we're talking about genetics, the question was, who got the Powell brain? And I was a pretty loquacious, big talker as a kid. You know, I was reading at a fairly early age. And so there was a lot of speculation about whether Ray got the Powell brain. And of course, all my older sister ever did was get perfect grades and be the perfect student and, you know, graduate at the top of her class. And, you know, and yet all of the speculation was about Ray Powell and whether he got the Powell brain. And, you know, to what extent this was, you know, kind of the way that I presented myself, and to what extent it was just sort of, you know, natural sexism or whatever it was. I have a feeling, you know, that probably, you know, sort of, in fact, slowly was driving my sister a little nuts. Like, there's nothing that I can do to sort of, you know, live up to the Powell brain standard. And so in the end, what ended up happening was Ray Powell dropped out of college and joined the military because he couldn't make himself go to class. And Joanne Powell Kaufman is now Dr. Joanne Powell Kaufman and runs a genetics lab at Iowa State. And her job description is one that I can't even pronounce. So in 2011, I was giving up command of the Air Force Honor Guard, and my father came to the change of command ceremony, and so did my sister. And I told a version of that story during my change of command remarks and publicly conceded the matter of the Powell brain, which I think drew a good chuckle, but I also think my sister probably appreciated. So finally belated admission on my part, because you know, of course, when I was growing up, I wasn't at all interested in admitting that maybe she was smarter than I was, but admission that the Powell brain, probably the moniker did not belong to me.
Well, Ray, I think we are living evidence. You don't need brains to do a podcast.
Well, I'm not sure that's going to get us a lot of new listeners, but fortunately we have smart guests who can insert all the content. So, Jim, it's been fun. I think the next time we talk, I think I will probably be in a different city. I'm not sure which one that will be, whether it be somewhere here in the Southern Philippines or Taiwan or maybe back in California. But it's been good to see you, and we'll do this again soon.
Sounds good, Ray.
All right. And so for Jim and our producer, Ian, I'm Ray. Thanks for joining us for yet another edition of Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific?